loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, it's Wednesday, which means it's our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. Today, we talk about the impact on working people of government shutdowns. We'll also talk about the U.S. effort to overthrow the government of Venezuela and the Denver teacher strike. And then we continue with our weekly segment that also takes place on Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. The deal that congressional negotiators have come up with to fund the government and avoid another shutdown is being drafted by staff members, and there is some debate about key pieces of the legislation. Democratic aides claim that the bill will bring the number of beds for detention from the current 49,000 back to Obama-era levels of 35,000 beds, but the summary of the bill, as drafted by Senate Republican staffers, shows funding for more than 45,000 beds, and internal communications show funding adjustments that could allow for over 58,000 beds. In addition, the deal allows for $1,375,000,000 for new border fencing. Senate Republicans voted for rule changes today that will speed up the process of confirming nominees to government posts. Republicans accused congressional Democrats of obstructing the Trump administration's nominees. Under the new rule, debate on nominees would be limited to 2 hours, down from the current limit of 30 hours. Ahead of Nigeria's election this weekend, the Boko Haram terrorist group launched an apparent assassination attempt against a senior government official. A convoy transporting the governor of the northeastern state of Borno, a stronghold for Boko Haram, was targeted in a suicide attack. At least 3 people were killed. Huge protests are continuing in Haiti against corruption and the government of President Jovenel Moïse. During yesterday's marches, police repression led to 7 deaths and many others were injured. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news so far this week. It's Wednesday. That means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week so far and put them into perspective. On Friday, we do a segment called The Week in Review. We have the same guests for both. We're joined in studio by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Okay, where do we start? There's so much going on again. It looks like the government is going to stay open. Looks like there's going to be an agreement. We're going to talk about that. But what I want to talk about more importantly about whether or not this happens, whether this government sort of shutdown is prevented. During this segment, I'd like to talk about some of the things that are never talked about in terms of the human costs of a government shutdown. And again, I was looking at an article today, Jackie. The IRS was shut down. The IRS was shut down, as were the other government agencies. Taxpayers get these messages that says serious consequences because you have a problem. And if you don't rectify the problem or prove that the problem, in fact, isn't really a problem, that it's the IRS mistake, you could have your assets frozen. You could have your assets seized. Guess what? At the beginning of the shutdown, when people were getting serious consequences messages from the IRS, and then they called the IRS to try to fix them, they didn't get a return call. But the schedule is the schedule. So a lot of people have been harmed. I mean, this is one of the underreported parts of this story.
Yeah, and I think that's such an incredibly punitive and hateful action and irresponsible action on behalf of the government, on behalf of the IRS, to punish people for something that taxpayers were not responsible for, and then to continue on with this schedule of coming after you when there was an entire month, 35 days, where taxpayers could not get the assistance they needed to rectify the situation. So it's like, you owe a debt to me. whether the debt is legitimate or not. And I'm just going to disappear for a month and a week.
And you can't reach me.
You can't reach me. But then when I come back, now I'm going to call in the debt.
Exactly.
That's wrong.
And again, this was a bogus. This whole shutdown has been over a bogus issue. This week, we had Donald Trump and Beto O'Rourke holding competing rallies in El Paso about the issue of the wall. Well, the people in El Paso and in the other border towns, the people who would most sort of recognize the need for a wall, if there was a need for a wall, they're actually not for a wall.
Donald Trump's whole presentation about the wall is that, well, we need the wall because violent crime is out of control and it's fueled by undocumented people. It's fueled by immigrants. And so if we have this wall, then they'll be kept out of the country and we'll be safer. So, and he said that El Paso has become like the center of violent crime. But it's not true. I mean, the violent crime, if you just look at the statistics, is like way down in El Paso. It mirrors every other major part of the country.
It's actually one of the safest medium-sized cities in America.
Yeah, I think it is the safe. I think it's been determined for a long time to be the safest place in the United States.
It's on a list.
It's been the safest city or among the safest city contestants since 1998, I think.
Right. I think people are starting to get tired of this gaslighting. But, you know, this was kind of fun. It was entertaining in the beginning where you know, night is day and white is black and whatever. But I think Americans are getting tired of this nonsensical lying, this constant litany of lies that come from the president's mouth. Everybody knows that El Paso is a safe city. Everybody knows that El Paso is not chaos and anarchy in the streets when the sun goes down because Mexicans are out, you know, raping and pillaging. It's just simply not true. And when you have the mayor come out and the local FBI SAC, the special agent in charge, coming out and saying that not a single word that the president said was true, people get tired of it.
Even though I'm not completely confident that it's accurate, there's a report that came out that said that most of the stories that Donald Trump says about the border are actually scenes from the movie Sicario.
Yes.
Which, I mean, the correlation is very eerie. I mean,
help the audience that doesn't watch, like Brian, I don't watch that.
It's an action. It's like a cheesy action movie, and it takes place in large part along the U.S.-Mexico border. And some of the scenes that Donald Trump depicts when he's talking about, oh, the chaos and the horrific stuff that's going on at the border to justify why it's a crisis, those things can't actually be verified. Like, journalists have tried to verify them, but somebody noticed that a lot of the things that he says over and over again are scenes from this action movie Sicario, like
rugs
being found along the U.S.-Mexico border, the women being like duct taped into a trunk of a car.
Wow.
It's all from the movie. None of it ever happened.
You remember, didn't John Wayne sort of talk about himself in World War II?
Yes.
Because he was in a lot of World War II movies.
And Ronald Reagan used to do the same thing. Ronald Reagan would recount stories from films he had seen as if they were fact and had just happened. He used to do it all the time.
All right. So there we have it. And we have people being, I don't know what the right word was. I was going to use a curse word, but we can't do that on radio. People being badly harmed. I was going to use another word. Badly harmed by the IRS. Lots of people didn't get back pay.
Right.
A lot of people took out loans during this time period, and those loans are not going away, and the loans are at high interest rates.
Yes. So, I mean, we're talking about, and not just loans from reputable financial institutions. I mean, some people actually had to go to payday lenders. So, which is why I never liked the idea of that people floated of government workers or contractors taking out a loan to pay their bills during the shutdown. People still have to pay that money back. The money that federal employees are, now we know they are going to get that back, that's still going to have to cover bills. And now they're going to have to pay off these loans also. But then we're talking about contractors who are not getting their money back. They're not getting leave that they were forced to take during this time off in order to get paid back. The contracting agencies are getting paid that money because that money was already appropriated when they signed those contracts. So all of this seems to me like this was a way to feed into more inequality, to further destabilize the economy, to make the financial sector, the predatory lending agencies, a little bit richer off the backs of working people. I know that sounds conspiratorial.
No, no, that's exactly what happened. You're right. That's exactly what happened. The bad guys came out ahead.
The bankers never miss an opportunity to make profit off of, you know, somebody's suffering. You know, the payday lenders are probably the most predatory. I mean, they're well known for charging, you know, unbelievably high exorbitant interest rates and targeting people who are in the most desperate financial situations. But, you know, any lending institution is basically the same business model, just maybe a little bit less extreme. And the effects of that, I think, ripple throughout the economy, because when you have a lot of debt, you know, consumers make different decisions about what they do with their money, right? Like if you, you know, max out all your credit cards, or, you know, you took out a $5,000 loan or something like that, you know, it's much less likely that you're going to go go out to eat, or, you know, buy a new car, you know, things that, you know, are generally like have a stimulating effect on the economy. So it slows all of that down too.
We're talking with Jackie Lookman and Walter Smolarek in this segment called In the News, where we take a look at some of the big stories so far this week. On Friday, we do the week in review with our same guest. John Kiriakou, one of the stories we talked with Daniel Sankey in our regular segment called False Prophets, this was yesterday, also a very big story and very connected to what we're talking about, is the record 7 million Americans who are 90 days or more behind on their auto loan payments.
Yeah.
Again,
if I hadn't seen that in the Wall Street Journal, I would not have believed it.
Yeah, so we're having a booming economy. That's what we're told. Stock market is booming.
We're at full employment.
Full employment. And yet you have a record level of Americans who can't make their car payments. Now, you were talking about predatory loans. These people, these are working class and lower income people. You know, if you have good credit, if you have a good high paying job, you might get a loan for a car that's like 3% or 4%, or a couple of years ago, just 2 years ago, 1%. These people, and this is millions of people, are paying 14%, 15%, even 20% on their car loans. And as the article in the Wall Street Journal said, a car loan is typically the first payment people make because a vehicle is critical to getting to work, and someone can live in a car if all else fails. When car loan delinquencies rise, it's usually a sign of significant duress among low-income and working-class Americans. Again, this is what's happening right now. What will the downturn, the economic recession, which is undoubtedly coming in the boom-bust cycle, because they come ever since 1825, they come every 7 to 10 years. This is one of the longest periods without a recession. When they do come, I mean, these people are not going to be able to pay their car payments at all.
I have a friend, a pretty close friend, who is in this kind of a situation that we're talking about. He's educated, college degree, he's a professional, lost his job a year ago, and has just simply been unable to find another job. Now, he made an interesting decision early on. As soon as he lost his job, he joined a gym. And I thought that was kind of an odd way to spend $500 if you've just lost your job. And he said, no, the gym has a shower. And if things really go bad, and he saw this coming, he at least has a place where he can go take a shower. Well, for the last 4 or 5 months, he's been living in his car. And every morning he goes to the gym and takes a shower and changes his clothes.
Oh, a lot of people do that.
And a lot of people do that.
I have a family member, again, down on his luck, wasn't able to keep a job for a little bit. He does have two jobs now, but for the longest time, he was on the street and going to the gym to shower, because some of the gyms are really low cost. So people are actually joining them just so that they can have a warm shower.
You know, the interesting thing about this story about the missed car payments among working class and poor people, I saw this story, I think it was in Bloomberg, and they made an observation that I thought was funny, but it was also obscene, that they said that the fact that 7 million Americans missed their car payments might mean that the economic that the economy isn't really that strong.
Imagine.
You think? I mean, and the other thing they noted in this article was that a credit score of 620 is considered subprime.
Subprime meaning then your loan is going to be 20%.
Yeah. Yeah, so even people, I mean, I tend not to pay that much attention to my credit score, honestly, because I know it's a racket. So I my mom left me my home, and this is just my personal thing. My mom died. I inherited the house. I pay the mortgage. The house is now in my name. We bought our cars from auction from our tax returns for the past few years. We're probably not going to be able to do that this year because of the tax law changes and because of the job market. It's tight and because of the shutdown. So we're not going to have that extra money. So we've got to hold on to these struggling cars for a little bit while longer, for at least another 2 years. So I don't really pay attention to my credit score because I don't intend to use credit. So I had no idea that a good credit score is considered is around 700 or 800 points. 600, 620 targets you for subprime, for, like you said, Brian, a 20% interest rate on a car loan, or being denied for a mortgage, or being denied auto insurance or health insurance. This entire economic system is a racket that is just built on impoverishing working people.
It's clear that we're getting towards the end of this business cycle, if you want to call it that way, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense for you to say, for anybody to predict like exactly when a recession is coming. But, you know, it's clear that this is, you know, towards the end. We can say that broadly. And unbelievably, even though recessions, which happen every 10 years, there's not like a reason for it. There's not a good logical reason for it, but that's the way this system is structured. Even though it's horrible for, you know, the vast majority of ordinary people because of all the things that we're just talking about, you know, unbelievably for a small group of corporations, recessions are awesome. They're great because that means that's your opportunity to swallow up all your competitors, right? I mean, so like we're talking about the auto industry, right? So in the Great Recession, you know, the big three, GM, Chrysler, and Ford became the big two, right? Because Ford and GM were able to survive, but Chrysler was bought up by Fiat, which is the Italian auto monopoly. And, you know, the big banks get rich off of all of this, too. I mean, a lot of the banks that got, you know, a huge billions and billions and billions of dollars of bailout money from us, from taxpayers, they were also able to swallow up their competitors, like Wells Fargo purchased Countrywide, I believe, is one of the mergers. So, yeah, I mean, for the people who are so rich, recessions are actually a good thing for them, unbelievably.
If you look at, if you go to Wikipedia, for instance, and type in list of defunct automobile manufacturers in the United States, these are car companies that are no longer. There are hundreds and hundreds of them.
Oh, boy.
There are hundreds and
hundreds
of them.
And we're not talking just about the Tucker.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's...
or the Duesenberg.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
We're talking about major, you know, we're talking about Plymouth and...
Right.
Yeah, and Saturn and a lot
Chevrolet.
Of other big boys.
I mean, all those companies have been swallowed up by other companies. The ones that were lucky enough to be swallowed up, the others just went bankrupt. But that's the process of monopolization that is inexorably continuing.
Well, there was a piece in the New York Times this week saying that just 20 years ago, which in my mind is, you know, the other day, there were 14,000 different banks in America, and today there are 3,800. The same thing is happening in the banking industry, and that is not a good thing for the American consumer.
And you look at media, I mean, the concentration in media, yeah, the concentration
right.
in banking, the concentration in auto, and all of these, like even right now, we're also having a record number of bankruptcies in American farms. Now, those farms and the land owned by those farms, they're not going to disappear. They're going to be swallowed up by agribusiness. So the smaller farmers, and when I'm talking about smaller farmer, I'm not talking about somebody out with a plow, a personal, you know, hand, you know, driven plow. I'm talking about people who have farms that are $5 million, $10, $20 million in assets. They're going under right now. Again, it's not bad for some parts of the economy. It's just bad for the people who have less. The people who are smaller always are at the losing end of this stick. Let's go on to another story, though, talking about the economy, but it's not simply about money. There's another strike. The Denver teachers, they have entered their third day of striking. Pay is an issue, but more important is about public education itself. Will there be funding for public education? This is a movement. We've talked about it with Bill Ayers. It's not just a labor movement. It's also a social movement. It's also basically a women's movement. Let's talk about it.
Again, I really love seeing this groundswell of grassroots advocacy for the least in our society, which are our kids. You know, these are educators who are in the classrooms. They've seen their profession basically be robbed by politicians for decades, to the point where they are having to pay for their own supplies out of their salaries that get smaller and smaller and smaller. Their classrooms get bigger and bigger. They have no representation by the politicians they elect. And not only are they fighting for themselves, but they're fighting for the kids they are educating. They're fighting for a better quality of education for this next generation of Americans. And they're also fighting for, like you said, Brian, the incursion of the privatization of public education that would push even more already marginalized, poor, underserved kids further onto the margins of society through making education, primary school education, an exclusive thing that only certain people get selected to receive. So they're getting a lot of resistance from the legislators in Denver. But I think this movement is going to go with every other teacher strike, go the way of every other teacher strike.
I agree. I think that's the fundamental issue that like, this is the question. Is education going to be a public good, or is it going to be a source of private profit for corporate entities and their investors? Even though, you know, the schools in Denver aren't, you know, fully, like in New Orleans, for instance, I mean, it's almost like fully privatized. And, you know, some cities are further along, but it's something that is present. I mean, it's the overall trend in the country, and it's present in every school district and in every city and town. You know, there's like for instance, the one of the main demands of the Denver teacher strike is to do away with this quote unquote like merit pay based system, where if you look at it in isolation, well, okay, there's pros and cons, and we can kind of see like where the administrators are coming from, but you have to understand in the larger context, right? So this idea that, you know, there's you know, your success as a teacher is measured by test scores, and you know, if we give you more money, then you'll be more motivated to make your students get higher score. I mean, it's like a totally cynical and ridiculous distortion of you know, the teaching profession and education as just sort of a thing in society generally. And it's sort of all points towards this corporatization of the process, which eventually, inevitably, will lead to the privatization of education. And so the teachers in Denver, inspired by the teachers in Los Angeles who won very important gains, who are inspired by the teachers in Arizona and in West Virginia, in the state of Virginia, there was a huge teacher demonstration a few weeks ago, which is, you know, something that hasn't happened in the state for a really long time. So it's clearly a national movement, because there's this national trend towards the privatization of education.
That was the voice of Walter Smolarek. We're speaking to Walter and Jackie Lookman in this segment of Loud and Clear called In the News. We take a look at the major stories so far this week. On Friday, both Jackie and Walter join us for the Week in Review. Let's turn to another story, a continuing story. It's about Venezuela. In the last days, supporters of Nicolas Maduro and the Bolivarian Project, which doesn't mean that they all necessarily support all parts of the Bolivarian Revolution, but they oppose the U.S. intervention and coup, they've had large numbers of people in the streets. You don't see it on mainstream Western U.S. media. Yesterday, Guaido's forces, the opposition, also in the streets. Clearly, the opposition has about maybe 35% of the population behind it. So if they want to have a demonstration, they can. But we're getting other reports this week that planes from Miami are coming with guns. And I was thinking, wow, it sounds just like Nicaragua. It sounds just like Elliot Abrams. It sounds like the criminal operations by the U.S. and the U.S. military and the CIA using private contractors.
And don't forget
to bring weapons to Nicaragua.
So many of the CIA leaders that are in place now, these are people who actually run the day-to-day operations of the CIA, came of age in that period where we were trying to overthrow the government of Nicaragua in the 1980s and prop up these fascist dictatorships in places like El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala. So this is what they've done for the last 30 and 35 years. They're experienced in this kind of thing, and we should be on the lookout for it.
Yeah. You remember Eugene Hassanfuss?
I sure do. He was shot down.
Yeah. And that was the Elliott Abrams stage of the U.S. was financing and funding a Contra war, meaning arming the former National Guardsmen who were the military forces of the thug dictator Somoza. The Reagan administration and the CIA put these people into battle against the Sandinistas. And that war went on and on and on. Eugene Hassenfuss became a big story because that's at the same time that the story came out that the United States government was circumventing Congress illegally. And that's why Oliver North and Elliott Abrams and most, a big part of the Reagan cabinet was actually found guilty of felonies.
Felonies.
Right? They were later pardoned.
I was going to say, what happened to them, though? They were all pardoned later, except for Oliver North, who went on to many, many millions and millions of dollars as an activist and a radio talk show host.
And what eventually happened is the U.S. promoted this terrible civil war, and about 80,000 Nicaraguans died. That was at a time when the country only had 2.5 million people. Ultimately, the U.S. said, have an election, have an election, have a new election. And some bigger part of the population, realizing this war would never end as long as the Sandinistas were in office, voted for the opposition. That's how the Sandinistas lost power in 1990. A certain part of the population just cried uncle, like we can't keep this war going. The U.S. is too strong. And even if they liked the Sandinistas, they wanted the war to end. Isn't that what the U.S. is doing now with Venezuela? Threatening an already, I mean, the country has been so sanctioned, it's got so many economic problems. And now the threat of war and maybe real war is coming.
Yeah, there's two ways that the United States could ignite a military conflict in Venezuela, which is what they're threatening to do over and over and over again. And by the way, what other country behaves like that? I mean, what other country says, you know, we're going to decide who your president is. And if you don't like it, we're going to wage war on your country and kill people until you accept our choice for president of your country. So they could do it through paramilitaries that are based out of Colombia that can begin to operate, carry out attacks along the border with Venezuela. And then that would, you know, undoubtedly be merged with this whole narrative about a humanitarian crisis and a huge, you know, exodus of people coming out of the country. Or the United States could launch a total outright invasion like they did in Panama. This is not something that the United States is unused to in Latin America. They've done it many, 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 many times over the course of centuries. And, you know, the United States has plenty of military hardware in the area. They have lots of bases in Colombia. And so it's a real serious threat. And the people of Venezuela are united, I think, in a lot of senses, even though there's, you know, a hard core of opposition supporters. But if you look at opinion polls, I mean, you know, 75-80% of Venezuelans all say, no, we reject any foreign intervention. We especially reject foreign military intervention, and we reject the sanctions, too.
Go ahead, Jackie. 40 seconds left.
Yeah, even as you said, Brian, the supporters of who are out there in support of Maduro, even if they are not fully in support of him as a leader, what they are opposed to is U.S. intervention. One of the people who was quoted who were out in support of Maduro in the demonstrations that we don't see in U.S. media, the protests in support of the democratically elected government, is one gentleman said, no one can impose a president on us. If the U.S. doesn't buy our oil, we'll find others who will. I mean, so the Venezuelan people are not unaware of what the United States is doing. So that's very important to make note of.
Yeah, and it's also a class war in Venezuela. You look at the who the crowds are for the government. They're poor people. They're working people. They're largely black and brown and indigenous people. The affluent, more affluent, upper and mainly white classes. No, they're with the opposition. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from Washington in studio by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at the big nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from Vermont this week by Kevin Camps. Well, Kevin joins us every week, but this week it's from Vermont. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Kevin, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian and John.
Thank you.
Green New Deal. What does it mean for the nuclear industry, and what is the nuclear industry's reaction? Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, it was exciting to see both AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York in the House, and Ed Markey in the Senate from Massachusetts, both Democrats, of course, unveil with like 30 of their colleagues from both chambers the Green New Deal resolution last Thursday on Capitol Hill. But the response of the nuclear power industry was immediate, and it was not a surprise, and that is that they're going to try to horn their way in, as they always do. And incredibly, I saw a statement from the Nuclear Energy Institute, a gentleman named John Kotek, who goes through the revolving door all the time. He used to be at the Department of Energy. Now he's with the industry, his true home. And he even tried to call nuclear renewable, which is just pretty Orwellian. They try to call it clean, which is also quite a stretch. But yeah, they're going to try to get in there. They're going to try to get the subsidies. And in fact, the news coverage, even in the mainstream so far, has largely focused on this dispute, this controversy. Is nuclear in? Is nuclear out? And the focus really went to a fact sheet that appeared for several hours on AOC's website, where it very clearly said nuclear is out. It's not a part of this. And the hoopla, the kerfuffle, the brouhaha that, you know, the nuclear power industry and its friends in Congress generated led to AOC taking down that fact sheet, and Markey during the press conference saying this is technology neutral. Any technology that can compete, can get it done in time and at cost, is to be considered. So away we go. This is going to be a big battle coming.
Kevin, a lot of people do say nuclear is clean. What do you say to those people? What, I mean, tell us why that's not true.
Well, look at the entire uranium fuel chain, from mining to milling to processing to enrichment to fuel fabrication to use in reactors to forever deadly radioactive waste. It's not clean. It's dirty at every stage. It's radioactively dirty. It involves a lot of toxic chemicals. And they like to, you know, the focus on carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions is important given the global climate catastrophe we face. But it's not our only environmental issue. There are other environmental issues. And so radioactive pollution of the environment is a problem. It causes cancer. It causes birth defects. It causes lots of health issues in people exposed to it. So we have to think more like four-dimensional chess. We can't just focus on one problem to the exclusion of all others. And the more rocks you pick up with nuclear, the dirtier you see. I mean, just take uranium mining and its impact on indigenous peoples, not just in the U.S. and Canada, but worldwide. They bear the brunt. They have suffered very badly from uranium mining, and that's just the first step in the uranium fuel chain.
The NEI letter that was put out, the statement that was put out, again, that's the Nuclear Energy Institute, has some really galling comments that you referenced. One, again, this is a statement from Maria Korsnick, the president and CEO at NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute. We commend efforts, and I'm quoting here from the statement, we commend efforts to promote the adoption of clean and zero emission sources of electricity to address climate change. Nuclear energy operates 24/7, generates 20% of U.S. electricity, and more than half of our carbon-free generation, more than all other sources of zero carbon electricity combined. Any approach to eliminating greenhouse gas emissions requires all clean energy technologies, including nuclear, to work together to address that urgent problem. There is a growing consensus among climate advocates, including the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Nature Conservancy, and even the Union of Concerned Scientists, that any climate solution must include nuclear energy. And here's my favorite part. Former Energy Secretary Ernie Moniz said this week that the notion of achieving a grid composed of 100% renewables by 2050 is, quote, not realistic. What's your reaction to that? Those initial paragraphs from Ms. Korsnick of NEI?
Well, Ernest Moniz was Obama's energy secretary, of course, and before that, his career was and still is devoted to nuclear energy. He's an MIT nuclear engineer, and he recently joined the board of directors of Southern Nuclear in Georgia. And talk about a conflict of interest. He's the one who approved $8.3 billion in nuclear loan guarantees as energy secretary. That's taxpayer money to build those two new reactors in Georgia. And now he serves on the board. So, you know, you got to take Ernie Moniz's statements with a grain of salt. He also recently said, well, it was 2017, that the reason we need to preserve nuclear power is in order to maintain our nuclear weapons deterrent, which completely contradicted everything the U.S. government had said for a half century up to that point, that the two were completely separate from each other, atoms for peace over here, nuclear weapons over there. And so now in desperation, as nuclear power plants, which are dangerously old, are shutting down, thankfully, at long last, Ernie Moniz shows up and says, no, we need that know-how, that technology to maintain our nuclear arsenal. So, you know, NEI has been doing this, of course, for decades. It's their dark job to spin the splitting of the atom, to boost profits for their member companies. And they're, you know, sometimes they're pretty good at it. And that's why this fight is going to be very intense going forward. But I have to put out there that Ed Markey, first in the House for decades, 1976 up until 2013, and since in the U.S. Senate, has been really a leading watchdog in Congress on the nuclear power industry as well as the nuclear weapons industry. So that alone, that history, his stellar reputation on these issues from our perspective speaks, you know, a lot as to what the Green New Deal actually is. But he's a savvy enough politician to know that you can't just try to get your way. You're going to have to build some alliances with people you don't usually work with to try to get things moving forward in this, you know, country of ours. So he was smart enough to say, hey, let's make it a level playing field. And if your industry, if your idea can compete in saving the climate and saving humankind from climate catastrophe, then, you know, let's hear it. But I think, you know, the record shows that nuclear power is too expensive, it takes too long, and has a long list of insurmountable risks all its own.
My only concern with that approach is that the nuclear industry, as we've talked about just already this morning or today, but as we talked about on the show a lot, that there's this revolving door that Ernie Moniz is such a good example of. He's a former energy secretary in the Obama administration, but is now working for a nuclear, you know, for the nuclear industry. So, you know, there are these very high up officials, former officials who have a lot of pull and who are doing a lot of lobbying. So I hope that, you know, when he says the notion of achieving a grid that's composed of 100% renewables isn't realistic, it's not realistic right now because the lobbying industry is requiring nuclear to be a part of things. But if we were to look at what was healthiest for the planet and if we were to really concentrate our funds and our monies and our policies into actually renewable energies, then it absolutely would be possible. Do you think that's right?
Well, I wish that Energy Secretary Moniz had spent more time at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory of the Department of Energy. Then he would know clearly that it's very doable. You know, Arjun Makajani at Institute for Energy and Environmental Research back in 2007 published a book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. And his position at the time, and it was considered radical at the time in 2007, was that by 2040, the United States could be carbon-free and nuclear-free. The largest economy on the planet could make that transition in a 30-year transition period. And since then, we've seen actual economies, not a technical study, but actual large economies like Germany, which will phase out nuclear power by 2022 as a direct response to Fukushima and Chernobyl before that. And by mid-century, Germany's greenhouse gas emissions will be reduced by an astounding level, something like 85% over 2005 levels. So that's the fourth largest economy in the world that's doing what Arjun said was possible to do by mid-century. So Ernie Moniz, like you said, Nicole, has an agenda. It's a pro-nuclear agenda. And truth be told, to some extent, the fossil fuel industry behaves the same way as the nuclear industry trying to horn in on the money. And that came up too, carbon capture and sequestration. Actually, Markey directly addressed that and said, if CCS can compete, then bring it on and we'll see how it goes. But the thing is, it's very expensive. It's unproven. So why not just do what makes the most sense and cost the least money? And that is energy efficiency, the lowest hanging fruit of all. And then after that, renewables like wind and solar.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, Nicole and Kevin, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who along with Markey made these announcements, introduced this, they passed out a fact sheet and they said this will not include any new monies for nuclear power. when you look at the new people coming into Congress, especially those who are considered to be progressive, do they have an anti-nuclear position in general, Kevin, or do we not yet know that?
It depends on the member. AOC, you know, just from that fact sheet that they withdrew, I think it's a sign that she has definite skepticism about nuclear power, and rightfully so. I mean, she's from New York City, and the Indian Point atomic plant just up the Hudson River, not too many miles, is slated to close in 2020, 2021, unless you read the fine print in the agreement to close, and it said if there's an electricity emergency, we may keep these two reactors so close to New York City operating. And remember that on 9/11, Muhammad Atta, the lead attacker, wanted to attack Indian Point, assumed that there were air defenses that would have, you know, stopped that from happening, when in fact there were no air defenses, and there still aren't. So I think, you know, there are a lot of new members of Congress who get all that, really, on some level, and they probably need some more education because they haven't focused on this question enough. And then you have, you know, experienced veterans like Ed Markey, who very much get from decades of working on it. But unfortunately, the industry has its talons into other members. Cory Booker stands out as a big name in that regard. Unfortunately, he is supportive of a New Jersey-based company called Holtec International that we've talked about a lot in the past because they want to open this mega dump for radioactive waste in New Mexico. So just on the environmental justice aspects of Holtec's misbehavior, you would think that Cory Booker would not be supportive of that, but we've got to do a lot of work on him.
So, Kevin, where do you see this going? It started off, I think, really strong with the fact sheet that we talked about. That got rescinded. I know there have also been some criticisms that it won't fully get rid of fossil fuels entirely, but it still seems like a strong set of proposals that would both create jobs and really do way more than anything else that we've done as a nation towards ending or changing our climate change problem. Do you see this? You know, McConnell has said, I think he would bring it to the Senate floor. Where do you see the actual package going, both in terms of content and in terms of, you know, will people actually vote for it?
Well, you know, I commend the majority leader, McConnell, of taking it to the floor. He's thinking he's calling the bluff of Democrats who are running for president, that they'll go on record as supporting the Green New Deal, and that can be used against them in the presidential race. But I think he may be miscalculating. I think the American people, by huge margins, support this idea. I think the Green New Deal without nuclear is a great frame on the issues. And as I read the resolution after it was introduced, it's not only saving the climate, it's also about economic justice, environmental justice, writ large across society, which makes a lot of sense because our energy economy is at the heart of our society in many ways. So I think that the authors, AOC and Markey, get that. They have strong support already from most of the Democratic presidential candidates that have announced thus far. And I think this thing has real traction. And I think it has partly to do, of course, with the worsening of the climate crisis, with things like the Camp Fire in California that was so horrific. I think that more and more people understand that we have to do something drastic. And I think invoking the New Deal is pretty powerful in that regard.
That was the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. You can read about Kevin, about what he's doing, what his colleagues are doing. Amazing grassroots work to bring public attention to the dangers of the nuclear power industry. And also, it's a David and Goliath fight because the nuclear industry, with the revolving door, meaning people going in and out of government positions and then into very high-paying jobs in the nuclear industry, have basically sequestered the nuclear industry in away from actual public transparency. We do this show here at Loud and Clear every week where we talk about these big issues, because we want the public to be informed and we also want the public to be involved. We're also joined on this segment, as we are each week, by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show.
Kevin, this is a short document. The Green New Deal is just 14 pages. Can you tell us actually what is actually in this deal? I think there have been a lot of fluffy thought pieces out there about this is good, this is bad. But what's actually in this?
Well, I think at the heart of it is a call for eliminating greenhouse gas emissions in just a decade, which is pretty daunting. Yes, it is. And this is a resolution, so the details have not been worked out, which is significant for this whole brouhaha about nuclear power in or out. That's yet to be determined, of course. That'll be a fight. So we'll see. But this transition, like I said, Arjun Makhijani at IEER called for this transition in 2007. That would have given us 23 years until 2030. Well, because of like what you said, Nicole, the coal and natural gas and oil and nuclear industries sabotaging renewables in this country for the past decade, well, guess what? We have less time to save the climate. And so that's why the urgency that AOC and Markey and others have put into this. It's a vision of getting things done as if we are facing a great risk. Like World War II was a great risk. We had to gear up for war against the fascists in a great big hurry, and we did, and by some miracle, we won that war. Well, we're facing another potential catastrophe in the form of a climate catastrophe, and we'd better take it seriously while we have, of course, President Trump and so many on the Republican side denying that it even exists. So that's the urgency. And like I said earlier, the economic and environmental justice aspects that they've also included, where there are lines in there about guaranteeing a good-paying job to every American. That's how many jobs they're talking about creating in renewables, millions of new jobs. So that was another brouhaha that erupted on the right anyway. There was a line in one of the supporting documents that said those unwilling to work would be supported. And when pressed, AOC staff said what we meant by that was a coal miner in West Virginia who's worked in that industry for 40 years and is not willing to undergo training to enter a new field, like, say, solar installation. You know, the person would be in their 60s, and that was their point. Those who have devoted their career to coal mining, for example, still need to be supported in a just transition through the death of the coal industry, essentially. And, you know, I think that's very reasonable.
That's reasonable and also, you know, incredibly important. And I think a value that we share as Americans, right? That like both the coal industry is not good for the planet and will increase, if we continue, you know, producing coal as we have, will increase the number of natural disasters we're seeing, will increase a lot of the problems that we're seeing in the planet as it warms. But also that the people who have worked in those coal mines also deserve, you know, what they deserve security, they deserve food, they deserve a house, you know, not just for all the work that they've done over the years, but because they're human beings and they need those things. So it's absolutely seems very reasonable to support both of those ideas at the same time. I wanted to read a couple of the broad goals that they've listed out. So there's five goals. One is to generate 100% of the nation's electric power from renewable sources. To build a national energy-efficient, smart electric power grid, something we've talked about on the show, how we have an aging grid and it's kind of in pieces. Number three, upgrade every residential and industrial building for energy efficiency. To your point, Kevin, earlier, energy efficiency is one of the easiest things to do. It's one of the low-hanging fruit that helps and is fairly easy to get moving. Number four, eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector as well as from farms, factories, and other industries. And number five, fund massive investment and make the U.S. a leading exporter of clean tech products and services. So, you know, one of the big questions has been, how do we fund this? And Ocasio-Cortez has had a couple of thoughts on that. But when we, you know, talk about nuclear energy on the show, we also talk about nuclear weapons on the show. And we talk about the money that the U.S. spends on war, on the accoutrement that comes along with war, on military occupations in other countries. And people have calculated that including not just the Department of Defense budget and the Pentagon budget, but including, if you include the Department of Energy's nuclear budget, those sorts of things, it adds up to about $1 trillion for defense spending. So, you know, if we were to make different decisions, we clearly have the money to do these things that are very, very important for the planet and for the literal next generations, that we could absolutely do these things that seem so important.
Right. I mean, $1 trillion per year, right? What you just said. And then you take these nuclear weapons modernization programs that are going to cost like $1.7 trillion over 30 years. And then certainly when you take a $700 billion per year Pentagon budget year after year after year and add this $1.7 trillion figure over 30 years, that's going to top it off at $1 trillion per year for the military and the nuclear military. So imagine if, you know, even a fraction, I wish all of it really, I wish a big fraction of that money were redirected to things like, you know, weatherization of low-income households. I mean, some of these proposals for efficiency are just very humane because there are people in this country numbering in the millions who live in homes that are not weatherized. And so in the wintertime, they suffer badly for lack of money to weatherize their homes. And, you know, the irony, the cynicism on the right is that many times to balance budget lines where the Pentagon gets everything they need and more, the nuclear industry gets subsidies for 50 solid plus years. The first thing to be cut by the right, by the Republicans in Congress, is things like home weatherization, you know. So it's just there are humane aspects to the Green New Deal that are very commendable.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. We have this segment, Beyond Nuclear, every Wednesday here at Loud and Clear. We're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. Kevin Camps, you know, I look at your website and the website of other grassroots organizations fighting against the myths and lies, the propaganda of the nuclear industry and their lapdogs in Congress, all of whom, you know, are also supported through the lobbying efforts. And then I look at another organization like NEI, Nuclear Energy Institute. It's a beautiful website. It's got the fundamentals, advocacy, advantages, resources, and it's a call to arms to defend and support and promote and expand nuclear power. Number one, preserve nuclear plants. Dozens of nuclear reactors in the United States may be at risk of closing in the next 5 to 10 years. Of course, that would be the work that you're trying to do and others are trying to do. But according to the NEI, this preventing unnecessary plant closures can save jobs, secure our grid, and sustain progress on clean energy goals. And then it goes on with smarter regulations. With right-sized regulations, we can implement even safer technology and support our nuclear fleet. It's time to embrace a new generation of nuclear fuel designs and resolve lingering issues like second license renewals, decommissioning, and used nuclear fuel management. And then third, it's let's build new reactors. The next generation of reactors will protect the climate, boost the economy with long-term, well-paying jobs, and ensure our global leadership and national security. This is a very, you know, well-put-together advocacy for the things that you oppose 100%. Let's just talk about who this organization is and how this propaganda system works, because when I look at the top of the website, you kind of can't tell where they get their money from. Are they funded by the nuclear industry?
Well, the Nuclear Energy Institute is the nuclear power industry. This is their lobbying and public relations headquarters in Washington, D.C. And, you know, they crawl all over the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, also the Department of Energy, also Capitol Hill, also the White House. They are one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States. And I mentioned John Kotek earlier. He used to be at the Department of Energy Office of Nuclear Energy, which granted is mandated to promote nuclear energy. And boy, does he ever. But the thing is, he went through the revolving door and joined the Nuclear Energy Institute as a chief policy strategist there, senior staffer, a vice president. And what really irks me about John Kotek is that he ran, under the Obama administration, he ran the consent-based siting public comment period for a couple years on high-level radioactive waste. And just the cynicism of somebody like John Kotek heading up that process, because people all over the country said, we do not consent. We do not consent to having high-level radioactive waste hauled through our town on trucks, trains, or barges. We do not consent in New Mexico, Texas, Nevada to having it dumped on our community against our will. And guess what? It fell on complete deaf ears at DOE. John Kotek was not really that interested in what the people had to say, even though he was supposed to be collecting those comments. So, yeah, NEI is quite Orwellian in many ways, and they are very well funded.
One other interesting piece of this, Francis O'Sullivan has been quoted in a couple of articles. He's the head of research at the MIT Energy Initiative. And one thing he's bringing up as a negative point, he's saying that it could create these big renewable energy jobs and also the increase of renewable power could create market complications. And what he means by that is that in California, they've in some places created too much wind and solar power for what their grid is capable of holding, what, you know, they're able to keep in reserve. It's not up to date yet. They're not able to really keep that much energy in reserve. The solar and wind power that California has created, they created so much that the price of energy went down. And it went down so much that it apparently created market irregularities or whatever. But I don't see that as a bad thing. That means there's so much energy being created that if we were to actually put money and time and energy into fleshing out the grid that the Green New Deal talks about, that we would be able to capture much more energy and be able to use that for people all over the country. It is completely bonkers to me that someone is talking about that as a negative.
Yeah, lower electric bills would be good news for a lot of Americans. And it points to the importance of storage technologies, whether it be batteries or compressed air energy storage or pumped water energy storage. There are ways to smooth off these hard edges, certainly. And it just is going to take creativity. It's going to take smarts. That's a part of the smart grid, too. And we can get this done. I mean, that's what Arjun pointed out in his book 12 years ago at this point. So countries like Germany are getting it done. The United States has vastly more renewable resources than Germany does, and we can certainly do it here too. It just takes the political will.
Only in the U.S. and only with capitalism is it that creating more energy is a bad thing, Brian.
Yeah. You know, we have 1 minute left, Kevin. You know, in the weeks coming up, I want to talk about what happened at Three Mile Island. It was 40 years ago, this coming March 28th. And I'm even looking now at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission website, and what you learn about what happened at Three Mile Island, which generated a mass movement in the United States, was that nothing bad happened. There was no fallout. There was no bad effects. It would be like having a chest x-ray once every 6 years or something like that. Really, really remarkable. Kevin, I think it's important as we approach this anniversary that we actually go back and help educate ourselves and our audience about what this meant. 10 seconds left.
Yeah, we have a Three Mile Island truth section on our website. A lot of people got sick and some people died. It was a disaster.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. He joined us from Vermont. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. In our upcoming segments of this show, we're going to talk more about what actually happened at Three Mile Island and the movement it generated. We were also joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.